Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
A crazed, bug-eyed Tadhg Furlong celebrating winning a scrum penalty like he just won the World Cup. CJ Stander crying his eyes out at full time on the phone to his wife back in South Africa. Multiple English players gingerly picking themselves up off the ground after being Robbie Henshawed in the first 20 minutes. So many images, such a great performance. So nice to have a big Ireland win to talk about for the first time in what seems like a long time on the Second Captain's Podcast. And that's not even mentioning the madness in Paris just yet. Hi, Murph.
Hey, Owen, how's it going?
It's going pretty well. Hi, Ken.
Owen, how are you?
I'm sure you enjoyed the Tadhg Furlong moment, Murph, because the cliche of the GAA background in rugby is always used when somebody does what Hugo Keenan, for example, did. I don't even know if Hugo Keenan has a GAA background, but GAA background, we can catch high balls. But no, Tadhg Furlong brought new meaning to it. He took that one straight from the hurling fields of Ireland. I think that celebration of winning a free, as it would be in hurling.
Winning a free in the first 7 minutes of a Munster hurling championship quarter final. If he was playing for Waterford in the last 20 years.
Yeah, I always have Milan in my mind when I'm thinking of these things, all right?
Yeah. Well, it was the whole... Owen Kelly was a great man as well. Yeah. Owen Kelly Waterford. Great man for just pointlessly celebrating, you know, random frees in any position in the field being won. But yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, at that moment, I did something similar in my own sitting room. So, I mean, I can't sit here in judgment of Tadhg Furlong.
Yeah, no. If it is judgment, but it's judgment in a positive sense, what a legend Tadhg Furlong is. What a championship he's had, actually. I'm sure we'll get to him with the guys. Many great images, but we don't deal in images. Audio is our business. So let's play you a clip incorporating the two best things to come out of the month of March, Synth Week and Keith Earls' try off a training ground set piece routine.
You lose.
England have been absolutely ripped to shreds.
Here comes Rob Herring with the line of throw for Ireland on the England 10-metre line, far side. The ball is swept back. Here comes Keith Earls, gathers it now. Races inside the 22-metre line. Goes for the corner. Earls, far side of the pitch. Looks to touch it down. In for the try. Far side of the pitch. 22 minutes gone. Keith Earls with the try. From over the tail end of the line-out. Across on the far side. Liveliest man in the entire place was the Ireland fella on the wing. His name is Keith Earls.
Yeah, like
fantastic
Keith.
Fantastic Keith. I love it.
That's what we're talking about. I'm featuring the great Michael Corcoran on RT Radio 1 mixed in with the synth stylings of Ken. Spock
William
Quiz.
On Yeabor.
That's the one.
Right.
That's the one.
I'm sure you approve of that clip, Master of Synth.
Yeah, absolutely. I watched a bit of the game, actually. And
well, you really went above and beyond. This
I feel you haven't been heavily involved in these non-football shows on a Monday, so it's good to see you watch a bit of the rugby.
There wasn't anything else on.
Mm. Oh, of course.
The
bloody FA Cup, eh?
Ken? Yeah, terrible stuff. But the try that Earls scored that was disallowed was brilliant.
Oh yeah,
yeah. It's so good. So, so good. I mean, the finish was absolutely ridiculous.
Oh, unbelievable. It's like an American football.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, over in Paris.
Baptiste sera le libère. Charlie joue en pivot. Encore Tamac. Allez, Tikou, Tikou, sur un ah, pas. Barcelona. Yes. 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 C'est incroyable cet essai de Brice Dulin qui permet aux Français de s'imposer avec le bonus offensif. Les Gallois n'en reviennent pas à la 82e minute. Ouh là là.
Ouh là là, indeed. That wasn't ooh la la at the end, right? That's
it was.
That's
it was
certainly the way I heard it as Brice.
I think we might have been we might have been saying ooh la la wrong all these years, judging by that French commentator. But yes, yeah, that's definitely what it was.
Dulan put a dagger in Welsh hearts with the last play of that game. I mean, that was just, it kind of was a super Saturday, Murph, wasn't it? I must say, I did quite enjoy
it.
That
was
Wales
brilliant. Like, and kind of a lot of the talk about Wales, I mean, it's been a little weird the last couple of weeks, I think, you know? Like the this idea that Wales have been poxing their way to the Six Nations. Like, they have obviously gotten a couple of decisions going their way and all the rest. But, like, the first 70 minutes of that game, they were absolutely amazingly
Yeah, this
brilliant.
Was their best. And they've played good stuff at times in some of those other games as well. It's true. But, yeah, it was definitely their best performance against Wales. Against France, for most of it.
But like a huge part of the England game, really, really good as well. And like, there's still a part of me that kind of hopes France win the tournament, because I think they're the best team in the tournament. But like, at the same time, kind of hard to make that argument after Saturday night. Like, watching what Wales had done to them, it was just, they were so, so good, and it was just so entertaining. It was unbelievably entertaining. Like, the whole thing was just such a laugh.
Well, the entire championship does go down to the wire again in Paris this coming Friday night. Wales, they have to watch and hope that the Scots do them a favour by not getting absolutely wellied by France. Surely they won't, if this man has anything to say about it. It's Hogglebox.
You know, I had a huge amount of belief within the boys to come down here and win.
Stuart Hogg turns up to fucking winning the bloody World Cup. I love it.
Stuart Hogg.
I believed in the boys' ability.
Man of the match.
Scotland are a disgrace to World Cup. Yes, it's Hogwatch, Hogglebox. What was the one that Mark was trying to get off?
Watch Hog.
Yeah, forget that. Forget that.
That was your one.
No, well, it was Mark. Mark said you should try and call it Hog. Listen, it's not for me to start, you know, transferring blame.
What is Watch Hog actually based on? What's the original?
Watchdog, I presume.
Yeah. No. Anyway.
Make any sense at all.
I can already hear you saying it's only Italy. Well, shut up, Owen. Because what you saw on Saturday was truly historic. The biggest victory in Scotland's proud rugby history in this proud and indeed historic rugby tournament. Our man stepped into the out half role, fly half, some would call it, and replaced his fullback jester's hat with the top hat and tails of the circus ringmaster. He said afterwards, "At times we lacked that clinical edge, but I'm chuffed to bits with that. The guys put in a big performance, and that's where we want to be. It's the little things that have killed us. That's been bitterly disappointing. But today was more like us." Indeed, indeed. Although I would say that this entire tournament has been more like Scotland than perhaps any tournament in living memory. They move on to Paris now, full of regret, deflated. Even their celebrity friends, Shane Horgan, having finally said goodbye, good luck, you're a pack of losers. Scotland 30, France 27, and I mean, it's the most obvious prediction you've ever heard, right? Play the fucking bed.
You know, I had a huge amount of belief within the boys to come down here and win.
Stuart Hogg turns up
to
winning the bloody World Cup. I love it.
Stuart Hogg.
I believed in the boys' ability.
Man of the match.
Scotland are a disgrace to World Cup. So how would that actually affect the Six Nations table? That
oh, hold on. I like this, Murph. Well, so you have now taken off your Hogglebox hat and you've put on your...
High on the hog. He's high on the hog now.
I like it.
So to win the trophy...
We're doing permutations. I like it.
Hog yeah. Wild.
So to win the trophy, France have to beat Scotland. They do have to go hog wild on Scotland. They have to beat them by 21 points with a bonus point for scoring 4 tries. Scotland could finish as high as second, but we know that's not going to happen. So if Scotland do beat France 30-27 without a bonus point, as I have now predicted here on this show, that would still not be enough to lift them above Ireland. France would secure a losing bonus point, which would lift them to second. Ireland would finish third, and Scotland would finish fourth. Beat England away and France away and finish fourth. That sounds about right, doesn't it?
I've got one more for you though, Murph.
Is this sorry, go on.
Go on.
They
can do it. They can do it. France do need the bonus point win, but they don't necessarily have to get to 21 points. If they get to 20 points and score at least 6 tries, that would also that's the one other
that also gets
very
them over
the very
line.
Very yeah. specific scenario that would get the job done. Sorry, Ken.
Well, it just seems like there's something weird about the Six Nations, and maybe it's just that I haven't been following it very closely. But it seems
you've got the helicopter view, Ken. You know what I mean? Instead of looking at the specific games or anything that actually happened in the games, what you're getting is the whole view, the perspective. It's like when you step back from a painting, you know, in your case, about a mile and a half back from the painting, so that you can get to see it in its full surroundings. So I'll be very interested to hear the point you're about to make here, Ken.
Well, it's just that everybody seems to be quite happy with how things have gone for them. Like, Ireland are third or second or whatever, but like, will be third, I guess, probably, maybe fourth.
Yeah.
But like, still seem quite pleased. Like, Wales are sort of, you know, have been delighted. France seem extremely happy with themselves. Scotland obviously feel themselves to be ablaze with, you know, energy of some kind. And, you know, even England are kind of,
England are about to sack their coach. So they're not happy. Well, he's at least been brought in for high stakes talks. So we'll see what happens.
And then
there.
Obviously you've got Italy at the bottom, and they're like that. Is that short story?
They're just delighted to be here. I mean, Italy might be happiest of all.
What's the short story?
The ones who walk away from Omelas, I think it's called, where there's like this there's this beautiful city which is like a sort of a shining city on the hill community. It's like it's a paradise basically. The one catch is that there's a child who's being kept in a dungeon somewhere in a state of perpetual misery, fear, deprivation. And that's the one condition for the happiness of this entire city. Like, the city is utopia. Everybody in it is really happy. But it comes at this price that there is this one child who is, well, I mean, basically is carrying the can for the whole shebang.
I would
and that's Italy.
I would equate Italy with me and McDevitt at that movie premiere about a week before the first COVID case in Ireland.
Our last social interaction, yeah.
Yeah, Nicola Coughlin is talking to Hosier in one corner. Me and Owen are just delighted we haven't been thrown out yet in lieu of other more famous people.
Who's Michael Fassbender in this scenario? Is he France?
He brings
a bit of suave, a bit of Hollywood cool.
But you know, if we can just tear our thoughts away from the unhappiness of the Italy child, and look around, is there something just a little bit blissed out about the Six Nations?
Like, Scotland shouldn't be happy. They blew it after winning against England. England aren't happy. But you are right. Yeah, Wales, Ireland, and France. Well, it's kind of strange for three teams to be feeling pretty good about themselves.
Yeah, well, Wales also did lose a Grand Slam with a try in the second minute of injury time. I mean, they were literally one handling error away from winning the Grand Slam. So I don't think Wales are feeling that amazing. I mean, that was pretty tough for them, I would say, on Saturday evening. And, Ireland, sure, did beat England, but are we absolutely delighted with it? I mean, what I'm saying is no one's happy, kid. One team in the Six Nations who's actually happy.
Well, look, I think that's the way it is.
France nearly blew it against Wales. Like, have already lost to England, the game that they felt they had to win. I mean, everyone was saying they were Grand Slam champions in waiting. So, no one's happy, Ken.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, that's the thing about the Ursula K. Le Guin story, you know. I mean, it's like, can you ignore what's going on here? You know, can you just give in to utopia? Is it okay with you that's going on in the background, that Italy are there with no points, with like minus 180 points difference or whatever? I think people are just happy to be out of the house generally. And even if it means that you only finish fourth in the Six Nations, that's, you know, it's still a damn good series of days out.
Yeah. The other reason you
finish ahead of England.
But do you know what also makes you feel good is that the games involving there've been a lot of great games, you know. So it's like, even when Ireland have struggled early on, you're watching these other classics, you're watching Scotland beating England you know, and then on Saturday, obviously, it was just amazing to watch France against Wales. It was so much drama. So the matches,
Wales, Scotland, the funniest game of international rugby union ever played.
So even if when you take your own national allegiance out of it and you watch the other games, I think you're right, Ken. I'm leaning towards you. I think everybody's happy, certainly more than nobody's happy. But the most observant of you guys listening may have noticed that this podcast episode number is creeping ever closer to the magical 2000. In fact, we're going to hit that landmark this week, this Friday.
It's a whole new way of doing journalism. I
believe that. To celebrate, we're putting together some extremely special shows for our members over the next month. Now, yes, I said the next month, not just this week. I'm talking guest presenters, big name interviews, big name interviews, some throwback guests associated with Second Captains, and of course, there'll be some young own.
All right, lads, well, onto our season review, if you don't mind. Roddy, can I ask you, first of all, for a highlight and a lowlight, please?
A highlight and indeed a lowlight, please, Roddy. Oh. I mean, the low light. Was the low light necessary?
Yeah, such a great question, though. I mean, you know, whenever you're asking that question, you know that an interview has just gone sublimely.
And how big were those South African players, Peter?
Big men.
Big men. More details to follow for World Service members during the week on our 2000 episode celebration. It's going to be an awful lot of fun. Also this week, all the best coverage of Ireland's first World Cup qualifier away to Serbia and...
And who wrote it?
I can't remember his name.
I'll tell you who wrote it.
Gold in the Water is the latest addition to our Second Captain's classic sportsbook library. It's being placed there by Gary O'Toole, who's going to be on to tell us why this story of a load of swimmers dreaming of a shot at the Olympic Games remains his favourite sportsbook of all time. So there's a hell of a lot going on, as you can hear. You can sign up now to be a member on secondcaptains.com. It's only a fiver a month plus VAT. If not for the 2000th episode, then when exactly? That is the question I'm asking you. Now is the time, Monday only listeners. Now is also the time for Horgan and Trimble.
Now Fenwick, can he get the pass to JJ Williams? Surely a try for JJ.
He's thinking to get through. On goes danger.
Duggan, back to Campbell, back to Duggan. McLaughlin going for that line. And Ireland are in and over.
It was a little bit of a slow burn, this Ireland campaign in the Six Nations, but we got there in the end. Simon's with us to chat to Shane Horgan. Hi, Shane. How are things?
Very good after that weekend.
Yeah, I guess, Andrew, we can all head off feeling actually pretty good about the Irish team after all, or is that a stretch?
I think so. Does this justify everything? Last week I enjoyed Simon getting fired up, and in hindsight, because the boys played so well, I enjoy that even more, and I must go back and listen to that.
So wrong on so many levels, you were thinking.
Yeah, and actually, I looked through your Twitter feed to see how the tone changed even throughout the game. The first 5 minutes, you were fired up because lads were running into touch. Yeah. And then it all just changed.
That's it. I mean, so were we all blindsided here, Shane? Did we miss signs? I mean, Johnny Sexton afterwards was very clear in saying, I told you all that this was coming and none of you would believe me. So what do you reckon, Shane?
Yeah, I hope so. I hope we did. And, you know, there are elements that go on within camps, and there can be progress is being made, and it's not visible externally. So, but we can only base on what we see. And, you know, I don't think we saw that progress, but we saw a huge jump, both not just in results, because let's move away from that this was just a great result. It was a great result, but it was a really good performance with positive signs of progress. So and I have been in, and I think I've said this to you before, I've been in squads where, you know, externally we weren't showing what I thought was going on internally, and then all of a sudden it exploded and we kind of never looked back. And I hope that's the case for Ireland. Now, you know, does Ireland have everything sorted? Are we going to see that type of performance, you know, every time we see Ireland? I doubt it. And that's understandable as well. But I'm not that interested in that today. You know, I'm really interested in the fact that Ireland pulled out a huge performance against England under a lot of pressure in the last game of the Six Nations. And, like, I just didn't want to be here really dissecting another negative performance with no progress, talking about whether Andy Farrell should be in a job, you know, saying, is it likely that Mike Catt will be gone? You know, that doesn't have to be discussed today. What we can discuss is a phenomenal performance and hiding, giving England a hiding, which is something I wasn't expecting to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the Mike Catwood is funny now that you bring him up, because when we were talking to Paul Grayson last week, he was making the point that he hadn't seen anything from Mike Catt, any sort of a game plan that he felt. Essentially what he was saying was, look, Mike's a very nice guy who doesn't necessarily have the force of personality to get his ideas across under Andy Farrell, who's the dominant personality. So I don't know if Mike Catt had a personality transplant over the last week, or if Andy Farrell just listened more. But I mean, I don't know which one pleased you the most, Shane. The try off the line out by Keith Earls, the Jack Conan try, the disallowed try, which is maybe the best disallowed try we've ever scored.
Yeah, I thought we spoke about having to get the opportunity to score directly off set piece. It was a hallmark of Ireland's rugby for years. It's for me still the easiest way to score a try, because you've got eight forwards tied in an area, and you've got a huge amount of space, and you've got a constructed idea of what the opposition are going to do. So I was delighted to see it. It was executed perfectly by everyone involved. But also, it wasn't a run-in for Earlsy either. That was phenomenal. Beautiful step at pace, and finished it, you know, really well. So I was delighted with that. I thought the Jack Conan try demonstrated some of the positive stuff we're doing. I was still halfway through it. I was thinking, well, we're not really going anywhere. I think the kick was, and it was an effective kick. It was a brilliantly regathered kick, and I thought Hugo Keenan had a phenomenal day in the air. But I'd be a little bit worried if we were relying on that. So, you know, for that reason, the disallowed try was way more impressive for me. Like, there was so many different little wrinkles on it, to use the Eddie O'Sullivan term, where people were doing slightly different roles than you would expect. And Conor Murray seemed to have, I don't know, it was like he was on speed or something. He was like getting to the breakdown so fast, and it was getting into the 10's hands or whoever the first receiver was. So he was putting huge tempo in it, and it was just a lot of nice play. And what I would say, though, is for me, that opening period, Simon, and obviously you were sort of maybe you're feeling the same things as I was for that. First up, the ball goes to CJ. He runs directly into the man opposite him, chest to chest. And then we got the scrum in the midfield, and Bundiaki runs out. And England have this period of dominance. And I don't know if Ireland have the performance that they have but for Henshaw turning the game on its head with some really big moments. You know, nobody else was having those moments at that point. Then a couple of other guys started joining in, Byrne in particular. Then Conan had a couple of moments. Keenan started taking some balls. And then there was a whole mentality switch. So the emotion change, the sort of physicality dominance changed to Ireland. And then off the back of that, then we saw the expression of the more of that other type of play. So I'm seeing a few things linked together here, and not just a case of Ireland coming out and out from the blocks and having this sort of devastating performance. You can see what's linked into getting Ireland to the position that they're in, that they played.
Yeah, Andrew, I actually found it more satisfying, more encouraging that Ireland had to work their way into the game, think their way into the game. Because they didn't start well. They ran a touch twice. They gave away a lot of penalties. The English were on our line. Conor Murray missed an up and under. We were under pressure, and there were signs there that we were going the same way as we had over the previous 2 years. But Robbie Henshaw was sort of the one character there that I felt, even when we shouldn't believe, he still believed. He reminded me a bit of Keith Wood back in the 90s, where it was almost like an insane level of intensity and aggression and focus and mad sort of belief. And that has to be infectious, and the other players start to come into it more then. But I think there's been games where Ireland could just mow England down from the start with just pure passion and the CJ talk during the week. And England are almost like a boxer who take that early punch and can't recover. But this was different. This was Ireland. We started badly. We haven't been playing well for a couple of seasons. But then they still managed to pull out the accuracy of that Earls try, the Conan tap down, the throw from Herring, Keith Earls to have so much composure, win in space, and then finish the try. And I think when Ireland reflect on this, that will give them as much encouragement as the fact that, you know, they end up smashing England in the end. The fact that they had to really build their way into it.
Yeah, that was the moment of, I know we were talking about Cat, there's a lot of things I want to pick up on. The discussion about Cat, that was the moment that looked like there was a little bit of creativity, a little bit of thought. This is the way they defend. This is the way that we can exploit that. Having said that, that's been done before. It's been done before by Ireland. It's been done before by other teams. And the point I was going to make about Cat is, we don't need him to reinvent the wheel. We don't need him to bring in something that the world has never seen before on a rugby pitch. We just need him to do, or to bring to this Ireland team what I thought we saw at the weekend. And yes, we had the Earls moment, a little bit of creativity there. But more generally, our passing was crisp. We were so accurate. Our like the most basic thing in the game is catch pass. And we did that better than England. And as a result, we got more soft shoulders, the rucks became quicker. Then the next time you get the opportunity to catch pass, it's slightly easier, you got slightly more time. And we just did that, and we kind of, we, as you say, you know, we developed energy from that. The Henshaw, his contribution early on, and him, like Keith Wood, I think is a great comparison. He brought energy, he brought something, he almost reminded the players left and right of him, we're good enough to take this. We're good enough, you know, and we're capable of doing this. And I don't think that's a problem. Where England have got energy in the past, they've got it from Atuji, they've got it from Farrell, they've got it from George Ford. I think it's okay for one player, as long as it's not week in, week out, the same player. And to be fair, it kind of has been Henshaw quite often, the Six Nations. But I don't think it's the end of the world to have one player to stand up and say, right, follow me. And next week it'll be someone else, as long as there's a shared responsibility. But Henshaw, I thought he was incredible. He takes a lot of responsibility, and he needs to take a lot of the credit for him. A lot of energy. The other person who needs to take a lot of credit is CJ. No doubt there was a massive intangible boost in energy and emotion, whatever it was, total, like, very, very difficult to tie that down. It definitely played its part. Now, I know what you're saying, Simon. If that had been the case, it would have been from minute one. But I still think there's an impact that CJ made.
Just on that, on in terms of emotion and energy, and we've seen teams play, and we've had this discussion before about how far energy and emotion can bring you, and maybe it's 50% of the game. But what really was of interest to me was the way Ireland brought the change in the energy and emotion from, I think, England dominance to definite Ireland dominance. But how that emotion then played its part, I think, in the tactical side of things. And so it wasn't just about smashing England or carrying the ball really strongly. In some ways, well, definitely, it allowed Ireland to play smarter as well. And we haven't seen that connection. We haven't seen the connection between the importance and the necessity of having the emotion and the energy side of the game, but that then feeding into the more sophisticated side of the game. That, for me, if we can link those two things up, the world is our oyster.
Yeah. But just on the second try, Shane, the Conan one, I loved it actually more because it kind of felt like something sustainable that we could build into the future. You know, Keith Earls taking it twice as first receiver. The way Tadhg Furlong and Tadhg Byrne looped and offloaded, and the interaction between backs and forwards, the fact that it had the high kick in it, the Keenan catch, the variety, Conan twice seeing space, Bundiaki passing wide. I felt like it had about, didn't every single player besides Ian Henderson touch the ball in it? It felt like it had a positive contribution, like an awareness of space from almost every player involved, which is like, for those few, it was 3 minutes long, for those 3 minutes felt to me like, God, if we can kind of have that sort of awareness, then you can beat anybody.
That's really tough on Hendy, by the way, after that. Everybody else getting the touch. That's the highlight. We'll bring that up. A number of things there. One, and we brought it up, I think, last week as well. The French try against England, the line out, where they manufactured a move to make sure Dupont got his hands on the ball, because he is an effective player and he makes the opposition defence make decisions. It seemed as if we were more aware that we should be getting our best players on the ball. So, you know, and it seems strange to say this, but I feel like Keith Earls, almost his entire career, hasn't been exploited enough. You know, for someone who's completely, has so many caps, has so many tries for Ireland, but we didn't get him on the ball enough, you know. And if you comparison to, say, someone like Dricko, and how our whole game plan was created largely around, you know, making sure that he was a big part of everything Ireland did. And I think that's the conversation that we've been having as well about forwards and backs. And maybe this game sort of writes that conversation a little bit, because you know, Earls did have a huge impact on this game. And I think...
I wonder, Shaggy, with Earlsy, I wonder if something was said during the week or something was said to him in a team setting or a one-on-one, or if that was just for him personally, that was four games of frustration building up and he went, stuff this, I'm getting my hands on the ball early and I'm going to show what contribution I can make to this team.
Yeah, I don't know which one it was. I could say it could be a little bit of both. And then I think we've got the other thing that happens is when we had that set piece move, and he scored the try. And, you know, we've been there as well, Trims. You're, all right, the chest is pumped out. It's like, how do I get on the ball? Give me it. I'm on fire. I'm feeling great. And all of a sudden, you're like, get out of my way. I'm in the first receiver. Sexto, push out. And but that is, you know, that happens when you have that big early moment. What we really want is for that to happen just, you know, when the big moment isn't there. And that in itself creates big moments. So I don't know which one it is.
Well, that's Henshaw. What you're describing there is Henshaw, someone who didn't, he took the bull by the horns. He produced the energy. He didn't just feed off energy of a teammate. He said, this is me. I'm going to contribute something massive here. I'm going to do this. Like that's what he did. And he deserves credit for that.
But the players looked like they want to play this way, Shane. Johnny Sexton looked in, I mean, we've only touched on him so far. I thought he was absolutely extraordinary. Even for that disallowed try, the way he draws a defender, kicks. You see players passing like this all the time, but he actually kicks as he's being tackled and still manages, I've looked at it a few times, still manages to kick it, I think deliberately, slightly with the outside of the boot to get it in exactly the right spot to be finished. I mean, he was absolutely extraordinary. I don't know how much of Sexton's performance yesterday was down to the platform that the game plan gave him or how much you felt that he drove it, he took it flatter and he actually forced the issue for Ireland.
Yeah, I think one thing begets the other in many ways, and I wouldn't underestimate the importance of getting go forward ball. And I suppose that, again, it's linked to the energy, the emotion, the physicality in the first instance. And when we did start getting those slight gains, then the ball becomes faster, there's greater tempo, the defence isn't set in the same way, it's not as in your face. And then that allows to use those sort of little plays that we haven't seen and we've been, you know, constantly banging at it on against. It also means that you're more likely to take the ball moving forward at pace than those horrible stationary, you know, one-out runners that we've seen so many times. And then because it's easier to do that, you're more likely to do it. And then because you're doing it, you're gaining even more yards. And so it just keeps on rolling and rolling and rolling. And that does put your 10 in a much better position to make decisions and to run onto the ball. And in effect, that's what we're talking about with Sexton. It's a big thing that we thought, what has changed in Sexton's game? Where for me, he was all the way, you know, he was this incredible player who takes the ball early, holds, you know, receives it really early, meets the ball, runs forward, and then it was almost like he had a pass ready to fire and he could pick his pass, but he was always moving forward. And then even when he throws the pass, he'd keep on moving forward and he'd block off the defense. Now, that is incredible, a 10 play. And it was the one thing where we've all sort of questioned, well, with his age, is that the, you know, the area of the game that he's losing? So I think what we saw, of course, he's not going to be the player he was, you know, 5 years ago, and that's understandable. But given the right platform, he's still well able to take the ball to the line, and he's well able to stop that inside drift. And if he can do that, he's going to be, if he continues to do that, he's going to be sitting in that shirt for a while yet.
Well, on that though, I think it's too simplistic to say that a 10 like Johnny Sexton is playing better whenever he plays flatter at the line or he runs onto the ball with more pace, because there are particular defences when that's appropriate and there's defences whenever you have to stand and almost give the ball early, hold more depth, don't take anything out of the ball, give it early to give the guys outside you more time and space, because potentially, you know, the first 5 or 10 minutes we saw the line speed from England and I don't think we saw much pace out of Johnny on the ball. But once you start to soften that line speed, and then once you start to go at that line speed and get a little bit of a foothold in it, then that line speed is gone. I just noticed in round 20 or 30 minutes, the intensity of the English defence at the start is gone altogether, because we tricked them a couple of times. We got the better of them. We found soft shoulders. We got tip-ons. Tyke Byrne was just tipping on left, right and centre. Tyke Furlong, Hendy at one stage,
looked like he was trying to do that basketballer thing where you roll the ball down your arm and then over your shoulders, and then he knocked it on, unfortunately. But it just looked like players had time on the ball. Again, maybe that was because Johnny was taking a given early on just to give those guys time and space. So I know it does look a little bit clumsy whenever you see a 10 just taking a given and not taking anything out of the ball, but sometimes that can be the right thing to do.
Yeah, but I know what you mean. But I, you know, if you look over the, you know, really the last 2 years, when Sexton to some degree, but, you know, Ross Byrne in particular, like completely stationary, standing, delivering the ball. You know, don't get me wrong, I think Sexton scored, they scored a try against Italy, the Earl's try. And Sexton didn't take anything out of the ball, and it was in the opposition 22, because it's exactly the right thing to do. But he stood flat and then threw flat with, you know, that trio pass where they have the winger is up really flat. So, yeah, I definitely don't think that on every occasion that you have to be running to the line, because then you can eat up all the space. But I think we definitely did move away from it, and we got into this sort of stand deliver type mode that isn't beneficial to anyone, and it doesn't allow for forward momentum.
Trio pass. That's a call from the noughties, Shaggy. That's that's bringing me back.
Yeah, that was nice. I got Drickle gave me a few nice trios over the years. They're loving them. They're burnt into my memory. The other thing I think that we saw is a movement, selection played a key role in this, particularly in the forwards, I think, and our more highly skilled forwards were more successful. And if you look at Tadhg Byrne now, you know, he is super key to what we're doing. You know, whether it be in the second row or be at six, this guy, we're finding a place for this guy in the team. Tadhg Furlong, of course, is, you know, the most bizarre mixture of this absolutely physical, aggressive, scrummaging, carrying monster and a subtle number 10 centre. He's just, you know, he offers so much to us. Jack Conan's selection, I think, was really significant. And, you know, I know it was CJ's, you know, last game, and he had a very aggressive performance. And actually, he dropped the ball off a few times as well. But I think there might be a benefit in not being able to pick CJ anymore, if that makes sense, because he gives you so much, and he is kind of the ultimate Andy Farrell player. Where we now can pick a different sort of back row, because we have to, and I think that might play into what we're doing here, because we're seeing, yes, emotion and energy is really important and vital, but we also need to have the players that are capable of doing the more highly skilled things, and we've got a lot of them now.
Yeah, we've got a lovely balance to it, and you can see the impact that makes. Imagine you bring Keelan Doris back into that back row, playing the way we all expect him to get, you know, the level that we expect him to get to. Will Connors, potentially. James Ryan, like a couple of years ago, he was everything in terms of Ireland going forward. And he's maybe dropped off a little bit, but I think it's just the guys around him. Henderson's playing out of his skin. There's just so much quality and so much to be excited about.
And Baird, like, this guy's a wonder kid as well. Do you know, he comes in all of a sudden, you're thinking, that second row, what's your selection of your second row? And it then impacts your back row. I think we've got, you know, some quality there, certainly. And then I think we can do more with our backs as well. We can develop what we're trying to do with our backs. And there was some good play, and there will. But I think we're seeing a roadmap here of how Ireland should be looking to play, and it does mean, I think, a few more changes in selection.
Trimby, can you, from your career, think back to, because I think the biggest change, besides personnel, as you were touching there, is the accuracy of the passing. Murray's passing was so good the whole game. I thought it was his best game in years. Why the quality of passing would change so much from one game to the next? Did that ever happen in your career? And is there any way of explaining it?
I thought the quality of passing under Schmidt was always really good. But it, as you say, it wasn't good 1 week and then poor the next. Like, there was no distinct change 1 week to the next. So I don't know is the answer to your question. But I know that it's so, so important just to rep that over and over and over again. I mean, it's the basics, it's the foundation. I do think Ireland, I don't think it's a change of style. I just think it's a change of accuracy. I just think that's all that's changed. I don't think Ireland have been anywhere near accurate enough to find space in the edge, and that makes them look as if they're more conservative.
I think that's an interesting point, that has Ireland's style changed dramatically? And I think maybe going into a number of these games, this is what maybe is frustrating for the players as well, when we analyse it afterwards. Like, going into the games, they would have had, you know, maybe not a dissimilar strategy to the England one. So, you know, some moves that they would want to pull in different areas of the field, and options to take. And I actually pulled up an example in the coverage on TV against Scotland, where there was a couple of times where we were perfectly set up, one off set piece, and then another one where we had, it was a sort of a rolling play where we had Tadhg Byrne, a first receiver. And we could have gone round the corner on both of them, but we didn't. We took the ball up the guts, and then it sort of all the space was eaten up and the defence was set. And we didn't do it. One of the Tadhg Byrne, I re-looked at it again, and the pass just wasn't quite right. And he had to almost, you know, regather it, and then he took it up. And then, actually, the option was on from the next phase as well, but everyone had shut down and said, actually, that option is gone. Let's just go back into our more basic play. And then from the line-out one against Scotland as well, there was a short line coming back. I think it was Ringrose. They were around the corner, but they took the front door option. Again, because I think the pass wasn't quite right. So I think the passing is vital to Ireland being able to implement their game plan. And then secondly, when you do that, when you take that other option, or you don't take the round the corner of the option, or you don't feel you can, then you're probably, as the game goes on, you're less and less likely to take it, because the defence have a more positive impact. The ball slows down. You know, they get off the line. You end up kicking the ball. And then you're kind of like, right, we haven't earned the right to go wide. Let's just take it up again. And then we get a bit of go forward. Then we'll try it the next play. But the next play never comes.
That's it. So, and you know what it did? Sorry to cut across you. What England always get energised about against us is like those big hits, smashing us back in midfield, knocking CJ Stander back a couple of metres. We didn't give them those targets, and they just couldn't get energised in the game. And even when we had 14 men, they still just looked beat because they didn't know who to tackle.
Yeah, they never had, this game might be different, just for all the reasons we've just mentioned there, if England started capitalised on the start that they made, and actually the poor start Ireland made, because, you know, we don't know whether Ireland would be able to switch the energy and then switch the emotion. But they did, and they never got into two things. They never did on their attack. They never got, as you said, smashed. So they never got in a position where they were dominated one-on-one outside the ruck, really, or consistently over a period of moments before we dragged ourselves back into the game. We didn't give up a cheap score, which was vital, and one of the things that we said that we couldn't do. We never gave them a score. And then we never allowed them easy yards over the gain line as well. So we were very, very physical in defence. Like, very, again, some of their biggest runners, we stopped them dead, and we also turned them over and stripped them a couple of times as well. Again, that built into everything that we were doing from an energy perspective, and everything seemed to flow from that.
Andrew Stuart Barnes is saying this weekend that it's the end of the road for Eddie Jones. He must go. What do you think?
Well, it was the end of the road for Andy Farrell last week. I don't think so. I think Eddie Jones has proved that he can dig deep and he can produce a big performance every now and again. Now, he's not doing it consistently, but he can get this English side going. Like that performance against France, I said this a couple of times, it was incredible, their level of accuracy, and it's just mad how different one week to the next.
But Andrew, that was partly down to Eddie Jones. Did you see his stuff during the week? He was basically saying, oh, we're obviously not going to be able to play like that again because Ireland are going to shut down the space. They seem to be quite scarred by the World Cup final. And he made that point that when you play as well as you did in the semi-final against New Zealand, you're not going to be allowed to play. So it was almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy, I thought.
Yeah, but you never know what when he says stuff in press conferences. Which is, he could mean the complete opposite, and he keeps people guessing. So I think nobody reads into anything he says.
So maybe he did want to play a bit of rugby again, but it just didn't work out. Is that what you're
potentially
saying?
Yeah, but I think you're right. Yeah, there's something in that with... maybe he feels like if we play that style of rugby one week, we're pushing our luck if we're going to get away with it, or we're going to be as accurate the following week. And I think he likes the idea of being able to play one way and get a win and play another way. And the other way, the ugly way or the physical way or the confrontational way, was the way that he got a win against Ireland in the past. And he's done it for four times in a row now. Four times, isn't it?
Yeah.
So why would it not work again? I suppose is what he's thinking.
But Trims, I think on that, I don't think their game plan necessarily changed week in, week out. To use your analogy with Ireland, I think the problem for England is that their game plan, for their game plan to be successful, it seems that they have to have this sort of incredible, almost physical dominance, and certainly over Ireland. And when that didn't happen, you could, or after the initial period where there was no score and then Ireland weren't wilting, you could almost see it in the players that they were looking around going, this isn't
Shane,
the script.
There was a moment and the body language thing can sometimes be overdone, but there's a moment early in the second half when Billy Vunipola had the ball stripped from him by Van der Fleer, and he literally just looked like he's shaking his head, he's trudging back while the rest of his defensive line is trying to get set. And I thought that happened. There was a load of, if a body language expert would have a field there, I think, with that England team. They looked bedraggled from about the half hour point.
There was a lot of, this isn't meant to be happening to us, and it's not meant to be happening against this team. And if there is something that you need to change around the England team, it's Eddie Jones needs to change that, because this England team shouldn't be losing to Scotland. That just shouldn't be happening. You know, they shouldn't have lost to Wales, and, you know, I wouldn't say they shouldn't have lost to Ireland, because that performance was so good by Ireland. They all hands up, they were beaten there. But they shouldn't be performing at the level that they performed at against Ireland. So it can't be that everything good that England do has to come from a complete physical dominance in the forwards, because we've seen that's fallen down. It fell down against Scotland, it fell down against Ireland, and more importantly for Eddie Jones, it fell down in the World Cup final. So he needs to rectify that. But, you know, I've worked with Stuart Barnes. I think he's a very clued in commentator. I think he knows the stuff about rugby, but I would not be changing Eddie Jones. I think Eddie Jones is one of the best coaches in world rugby, and he has demonstrated time after time that he can set up teams to be incredibly successful. He certainly needs to sort of reevaluate. I think he needs to change some personnel. I think he's got a loyalty to some players that he has to look at again. And no, so nobody likes Billy Vunipola more than me as a player, but Billy Vunipola is well out of shape at the moment. He's not the shape he should be as an international rugby player, and unless he addresses that, he shouldn't be picked for England.
Shane, you were off. I think you finished Virgin Media duty after the Ireland game, so I hope you got to relax and enjoy the madness on Saturday night between France and Wales. A suitable way to end a fairly crazy Six Nations.
Well,
haven't ended it, I should say that. It's still to be decided, but you know what I mean.
So I was upstairs. I came downstairs to, as we mentioned the other day, I've got a 3-week-old baby. So I would say within 5 minutes of going off air, I had baby puke all down my shoulder. So I watched it with her on my chest, which was a very nice thing to do.
That's showbiz.
Yeah.
That's
showbiz. So where's the green room? Where's my champagne popping? You know,
I hope you had the suit taken off by that stage.
Well,
at least.
I had my jacket taken off, but no, my shirt was more white than ever. But it was, I settled down, and it was a really nice way to watch the match as well, because I think sometimes when you're broadcasting, you don't get to enjoy it as much. I'm saying that I enjoyed the Ireland game, but you're looking at more with an analytical eye and sort of making notes. But this was just pure enjoyment. What a game. The Six Nations is such a good tournament. I love it so much. And this year, it's been spectacular. And that game...
Have you any theory on that, Shane? Why it's been so good?
I think there's a pressure that comes. Well, there's a uniqueness, unique qualities about all the rugby nations that are differing. They are. So it's not, you don't have a uniform approach to rugby. You don't have a uniform approach to how teams are selected or the build up of teams. So you've got the regions in Wales that don't really work, but they have this sort of teamship that creates something different. With England, you've got this huge number of players. France, again, a huge number of players and a tradition of playing in a certain way. Ireland have more consistency in selection because the players are grouped together at home. It's a slightly different thing. You can listen, the Italians are all at sea. Scotland are exactly the stereotype that Scotland have been since the start of the Six Nations and seem to continue to be. But that does allow them to pull out these incredible one-off performances and play some exciting rugby. So you've just got an absolute mixture that means that we get these incredibly exciting results. And you also get the pressure of a Six Nations Championship, even without an attended audience. The pressure that comes with it means you get mistakes, you get brilliant passages of play, you get players playing beyond their expectations. And the importance of a Six Nations and a Grand Slam can't be underestimated. We play a lot of and watch a lot of rugby that doesn't actually mean that much until the business end. The Six Nations means so much to everyone. And you know, if you perform in a Six Nations game, or if you win a series of Six Nations games, win a Grand Slam, you are there forever in the history of rugby. And that is something that's indelible. And that's why we see such, you know, high highs and low lows.
Did that emotional pressure get to Wales in the last 10 minutes, do you think, Andrew? I watched a little bit on BBC and they had Sam Warburton and Jamie Roberts at halftime. I couldn't get over how chilled out they were. They were just like, yeah, no, we're playing great. I mean, this is all going. It was 17 all, you know, and I was thinking, God, I don't think Irish pundits would be anywhere near as relaxed as this with a Grand Slam on the line. But do you think it got to those players? Did they crack in the last 10, 12 minutes?
They cracked, but I don't know if it was an emotional pressure. I think they cracked just because France were so good, and eventually that pressure told. Or France were certainly good enough to put them under pressure to get the score in the end. But maybe they're just used to it. They've won plenty of Grand Slams. They're way more accustomed to it than we are. And I just think it's bizarre. It's crazy. It's so strange that, having seen some of the performances and some of the luck that they've had, that they were that close to winning a Grand Slam. That is just bananas. And it's typical of this of Wales over the last 10, 15 years. They do better than they should.
And did you want them to win it, Trimby?
No way did I want them to win it. No way. Because they got the two red cards, they got the two tries against England. They shouldn't have been in that position. But we talked about this actually a few weeks ago. Fake confidence, right? And they turned that fake confidence into real confidence, and they grew, and they played really well in Paris, really well. They looked like a Grand Slam winning side, but that was one game. And I just think you potentially now, and still France, I still think France were better. So you could potentially have been in the situation where Wales win a Grand Slam and they were second best in four of the five games. And I just think it's crazy. But again, it shows what Wales are like. It shows how much character there is. We talked about England not being able to change things around, the body language, you know, momentum shifters, energy. Wales can do that incredibly well. They might not have as much talent or ability, but they can do that. And there's a lot to be said, and that wins them Grand Slams.
I think in fairness, that they did. Even, they got the lucky decisions against England, but England did come back and Wales had to win that one again. And even against Scotland, they were putting pressure on Scotland before the red card. But they did get, you mentioned two red cards. They actually got a third one against, you know, against an opposition team, and that was against France on Saturday night. Shane, what did Galtier say about this? If you watch the Wales players, it feels like they specialise in making sure opponents get red cards. Their body language is quite clear. I hope the referees take that into consideration. I don't think he deserves a sanction. So what do you, Wales essentially are buying these red cards, says Galti.
I think it's a nonsense. I think it's a nonsense, really. I don't think so. I think, you know, all the red cards have been clear and fair enough. And yes, they would have been given in other years potentially, but that's well, mind you, the eye gouging one would have been given in any year. I know it, you know, I'm not saying he was deliberately going for the eye, but that's not the point. And everybody who plays rugby knows that it's not the point. And if you're getting in that area, you know, you're dicing with death. So, those three red cards that Wales had, the opposition had, is entirely legitimate. And also, not giving away red cards is part of this game as well. So you can't just say, oh, the other team gave away red cards, so that means, you know, Wales were really lucky to win this. That's part of the discipline. It means that you keep, you know, 15 men on the pitch. And ultimately, not keeping 15 men on the pitch or 14 men on the pitch was what did for Wales. So so I don't appreciate those comments. I don't think they're accurate. But it's funny when you spoke about the emotion and the difference the impact of that Six Nations atmosphere has on your decision making. I did think, as I was, you know, sitting down, having a glass of wine in my, you know, carrying my baby, being able to watch this game with, you know, no emotion in it, I was thinking, when France were down to 14, the red card, and Wales still had 15, I thought it would be better here to let France score a try, restart, go down into the opposition 22 with 15 again 14 without the the potential of a sin being for your next infringement hanging over you in the 22, and actually squeeze out the game. And it's fine saying that, but you know, that's not the thinking that could ever enter your head, really.
I would like to hear that team talk. Lads, bring it in here. Right?
Yeah.
Listen, bear with me.
Yeah, but not to give up the try, but just to be so, just to say, you know, if it's a case of giving away a penalty here or not, you know, just do not under any circumstances give away the penalty and not being able to get that message out. And listen, I completely understand it. I don't think, you know, as the Welsh players could have done much more. You know, you could have, yes, no. You know,
and that's the mode they've been in all season. That's the mode they've been in all season. That's what's got them where they are. Just battle.
It's interesting because you can't in one hand say, oh, by the way, you need to defend less aggressively under these circumstances, because that is everything that has got you to that point. And it was the point I actually made about Bundyaki as well. I said, it is, you know, you cannot, I don't think you can castigate Bundyaki for the decision to go up high on Billy Vinopolo, recognising that, you know, being able to make hugely aggressive high hits on these massive England forwards is the basis for Ireland actually having their success up to that point.
One thing just on that France-Wales game, I loved the Stuart Pearce, Wayne Barnes. I loved the conversations, the theatre, what was going on, what were we looking at, what incident, is it a high shot, is it a gouge? And it only occurred to me once there were maybe 3 or 4 minutes into that conversation, and I was going, I'm not looking forward to the rugby come back on. Yes, that'll be great. But this conversation is theatre and it's interesting. and it's the first time that's occurred to me. That is actually part of the spectacle in a way.
Okay, I can't believe we're now in a situation where it all goes down to the last game. France have to beat Scotland. They have to score a bonus point and win by 21 points. Or if they were to win by exactly 20 points and score 6 tries, they'd win it on tries scored. At that stage, I mean, it's early in the week and we've probably enough going on in our head, but very quickly, are France going to win the Six Nations, Andrew?
Yeah, weirdly, we used to say you never know what you're going to get from France, but we actually do know what we're going to get from France, and that is true for Scotland. You never know what you're going to get. We could get the same Scottish side that played first half against Wales and played against England. I think hopefully, I'm a big France fan. right. I think France will do it.
Shane?
France now. I don't have any options to tip Scotland in this tournament anymore.
Yeah, but so, you're not tipping them to win. You're tipping them not to ship a bonus point and 21 point defeat.
No, it's not just I can't tip them to win. I can't give them any credit in their performance for this. Well, I may have to reevaluate after the Six Nations, but as of today, I think it's more likely that Scotland don't deliver a performance and France do.
Okay, at least Ireland's campaign is finishing high, guys. That was enjoyable. Thanks a mil.
Thanks a mil, guys.
Cheers, fellas.
Most sports nutrition experts would argue that the fueling begins, in fact the most important element of it is the day before, particularly the night before. So if you could take us through your routine.
To win the Premier League is a war on nutrition.
Okay, well the night before I had sort of a chicken salad.
Yeah, perfect.
Lovely, perfect.
I put a bit of pesto on, I put okay. Half a jar of
pesto. That's too much pesto, but it's not the end of the world.
And I actually bulked up that chicken salad with a little bit of Israeli couscous.
We're still okay. We're still in the realms of pretty good nutrition, I would say, the day before a race.
I had 2 beers.
It's the best thing in the world for you because it's full of protein.
Okay, not ideal, but not the end of the world.
I had a small Pringles.
You know the Ritter Sport bars?
I hadn't seen cornflake one before.
Nobody had any soup to start with, nobody had any puddings to finish with, they had fish and chips.
Okay, I had a whiskey and coke.
No, come on, not great. Not after the beers.
Well, it was a whiskey and coke zero.
You know, you probably know what direction I was thinking, we'll have another whiskey.
You could have one drink, no more, and then you're back to the hotel and you're off to bed.
Then I was thinking, what will I have?
Ah, you know what, I'll have a cup of tea.
Okay, perfect.
I had tea, then I had
a few digestive biscuits.
Well, there was a suggestion that there was sort of an all-you-can-eat sort of a thing going on.
I wasn't counting them. They were like buns to an elephant. I was just hoovering them up. And then just before I went to bed, I had a slice of toast with Nutella.
No!
It was whole grain bread.
Some big news before we wrap things up. You guys ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
Hit me up, Paul.
Orlando Bloom, Hollywood superstar, is a fan of Grunge Week. Yeah, well, he definitely would be a fan of Grunge Week if he was a fan of the Second Captain's podcast to begin with. He did an interview in the Sunday Times with Hannah Swirling, a life in the day, so his sort of daily routine. I like to earn my breakfast, so I just have some green powders that I mix with brain octane oil, a collagen powder for my hair or nails, and some protein. It's all quite LA, really. Then I'll go for a hike while I listen to some Nirvana or Stone Temple Pilots. Yes, excellent. I actually think Alice in Chains works better with the brain octane oil. I find that myself during Grunge Week, but, you know, each to his own. And Orlando Bloom is very much to his own in this article. By 9 a.m, it's breakfast, which is usually porridge, little hazelnut milk, cinnamon, vanilla paste, hazelnuts, goji berries. How much can you fit into one bowl? A vegan protein powder and a cup of PG Tips. I'm 90% plant-based, so I'll only eat a really good piece of red meat maybe once a month. I sometimes look at a cow and think, that's the most beautiful thing ever. At some point in time, we'll look back and not be able to believe we used to eat meat, says Orlando while still eating meat. But, you know, there's a lot of us in that boat, Orlando. I have a shower and get dressed. I like to make an effort. No tracksuit bottoms. I have a deal with Amazon where I work on my projects exclusively for them. I spend a lot of my time dreaming about roles for myself and others, for minorities and women. I'm trying to be a voice for everybody. Somebody put it up and said, I love that he's trying to be a voice for everybody. Minorities, women, and him. Those are the people that need a voice. I had this remarkable opening chapter to my career. Okay, it talks about Buddhism. It says, I've been changing the narrative of my head. I can feel I can be the driver of my train. I can set it alight, but I can get the fire crew and put it out. He talks about lunch. There's a lot of food stuff here, as there often is in these pieces. Mostly plant-based, vegetables or a stew. I will cook at times, but otherwise there's a team of people. Then I'll have a Zoom and read scripts. Started building Lego during COVID. I guess that's sort of mindfulness. We'll put the baby to bed. Then it's dinner time. After that, I watch a movie or a documentary for work. I aim to get to bed by 11. Disappointing lack of detail in dinner time. I mean, it feels like he's done all his work there for breakfast and then his team of people have made him a nice lunch and we don't hear anything about dinner.
I think that's where he eats his fry, but I mean, I'm not entirely sure that's what he wants to put out into the world. No, I can't help but feel, Owen, that rather than it being a 100% honest portrayal of an ordinary day in any person's life, that particular newspaper column is basically just a chance for people to show off what a, like, insane prick people can be sometimes. Like,
have you ever
bad.
Done that? Have you ever done one of these?
No.
I'd be interested in hearing your version of this.
Of life in the day.
Yeah, like
of Kieran Murphy.
I don't think he would have a line like, I will cook at times, but otherwise there's a team of people.
What is the point of this? Like,
well, how does he tell the team to stand down on the days when he's decided to cook? Randomly, like you can all go home. I would be interested in hearing your routine, though. I mean, not just as a sort of like trying to get one up on Orlando Bloom, because obviously I think it's unrealistic.
There are quite a few differences, is what I would say. There's quite a few differences between
There's much less grunge for Sartre. You don't listen to any songs.
No grunge whatsoever.
Yeah. It's kind
a
of
lot
amazing.
Of
tracks,
a lot of tracksuit bottoms. Like, you wouldn't believe how much tracksuit bottoms there is in my the story of my day.
And I mean, Orlando Bloom, like, you know, obviously he has the last laugh, I suppose. If everyone,
I feel like there'd be a lot of dead time in mine, you know. Spend half an hour staring brainlessly at my phone, not even reading anything, just existing in the world, just using up
sucked
air.
Into the black hole of social media in the way that Orlando Bloom isn't.
Refuses to be.
He's too smart. He only goes on to like put loads of Buddhism and wellness stuff every morning into his Instagram. But other than that, he doesn't use social media. I honestly would. So if you can maybe prepare that, I would be interested in hearing it.
Okay. Well, usually it's done. Maybe give me until Wednesday.
Well, at some stage
during this week, I'm definitely going to give you a life in the day of Kieran.
Yeah, but the thing is, these things are done. Yeah, but you shouldn't write it yourself. Like, these things are obviously ghosted. Orlando Bloom hasn't written this himself. Like, he's talked to someone at the Sunday Times.
So if I talk to Killian,
yeah,
Killian then has to write.
Yeah,
this
sorry, sorry,
for me.
Sorry, Killian. don't worry. But it doesn't have to be executed to an extremely high standard or anything. but I do want to hear. The routine. Yeah. Because I'm interested in the way other people live. Like, I mean, the way that I live is I sit here all day. I don't really do anything. I care for a small dog. That's it.
Fair enough.
I'm
happy to partake.
Get that. What did he call it? What was that brain stuff?
Brain octane oil.
I think you took that on, but it's not working out that well for you.
What? I was looking up something else here, and I actually zoned out for a second. What was the
It's okay, thing? Owen. It's okay, Owen. It's fine. It actually works better.
Baldness? Yeah. Was it baldness?
No, yeah, it wasn't. It actually wasn't baldness. It wasn't. It was brain related.
Oh, well, that's pretty harsh. That's all for this show. We will end on those awkward terms. Short Football Podcast available to everyone later on today. We've got a big week on the World Service coming up with the 2000th episode on the way. That's for World Service members only. We're going to leave you with a reminder of one of the best days of Six Nations rugby for a very long time. As Ken says, everyone is happy. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Owen.
Thanks, Murph.
Thanks, Owen. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks for listening.
Kieran.
Chat to you later.
Rob Herring logged it back, and that's taken down by Keith Earls. And Earls is through, and Earls has the sidestep, and he puts the foot in the gap.
Races inside the 22-meter line, goes from the corner,
and Earls is going to score for Ireland.
Earls far side of the pitch, looks to touch it down, in for the try!
Over he goes, the referee puts the hand up.
22 minutes gone, Ireland with the opening try at the Aviva Stadium. The ball flown over the tail end of the lineout, across on the far side. Liveliest man in the entire place was the Ireland put on the wing. His name is Keith Earls, he's got that one. He had a lot of work to do to finish it off, but he's finished it off in style. Try time for Ireland.
What one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.